Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. I'm sure most of you have been here before. Many of you maybe not. Some people are guest specific, and that's fine. That's fine. I imagine today's guest brought some people in. I have to assume so. Geezer Butler is the guest today. He's the bassist, or was the bassist and primary lyricist for Black Sabbath. I read his whole book. He wrote a book, Into the Void, From Birth to Black Sabbath and Beyond. Tomorrow night, I'm at the Vogue Theater here in Vancouver for a sold-out show. Then on Saturday, I'm in Seattle at the Moore Theater for an almost sold-out show. I don't know where that's at, actually. And I'll be in Tucson, Arizona at the Rialto Theater on Friday, September 30th. Then I'm in Phoenix at the Orpheum Theater on Saturday, September 21st. You can go to WTFpod.com for the tickets to all the things coming up. So when I was home, also I went to the Comedy Store, of course, to check in, dip my foot back in the water. No, just, you know, it's part of my life. It's part of the social fabric of my existence. So I went over there, and I hadn't been there in a week or two, or a week or however long it's been. And you just want to have a good set, man. You know, I've got these two theater dates coming up, the Vogue and the Moore, and, you know, I'm feeling a little rusty because I got out of the routine of doing the long shows. And, you know, I go to the Comedy Store, you know, see some friends, see some people, doing a spot in the main room. It's a little tight. I'm a little tight. They were fine. I resented them. But, you know, that's my nature. And I got up there, and it was going all right. Sometimes, man. But anyway, I'm in the middle of my set, and some guy, stage right, he just says, Maron. I'm like, what? He's like, there's someone having a seizure over there. And I'm like, what is happening? And this woman had gone down. She was on the ground. There was a few people around her. It didn't look like a seizure, but I didn't know how to read it. And she had just fainted, I think. But it was like one of those moments where I'm like, oh, that's why the jokes weren't landing, that last one. Kidding. It's one of those moments on stage where, you know, you have to stay up there. You have to manage a situation. I'm like, is there a doctor in the house? Which is kind of hacky, but I think in those moments, it's okay to use that one. And can we get some security? Can we get some help over here? And there were people around her, and she was, you know, kind of just the man that she was with was there, and a couple other people, and the door guy eventually came. But she was awake. She was conscious. And not in a seizure. It looked like she had just, you know, kind of fainted. And I was, you know, I tried to make a couple jokes. They didn't really land. And one of them, honestly, I thought was pretty solid. Because when it started to resolve itself, I can't leave the stage. I've got to handle the situation and kind of, you know, make it as, not, it's not a matter of making it funny, but it's just a matter of, you know, holding the space until the emergency is over. But they were like, do you want to go outside? And I was like, you should, you know, go get some air. And she's like, no, I'm fine. I'm good. I'm just going to sit. And, you know, and I saw in her eyes that she was, you know, kind of pulling it back together. And I said, welcome back. And I thought that was funny. It didn't really land. I guess, you know, it was too soon. It was literally still happening. But she was okay. She was okay. It was just one of those situations. And then I went back to do my set. And so that set wasn't great, but I'm glad she was okay. And then I went down the hall and did another one and blew off some steam, tried a couple new bits. They didn't work, but I felt loose because I'd already kind of been through it. You know, I'd managed a mild emergency situation. I'd eaten some shit and, you know, I was ready to blow off steam. If I can just get into that zone more often, like I used to, because I was always needing to blow off steam. But yeah, I just got to get into the present, man. Get into the present. The woman going down, that brought me into the present, but it was a serious situation. All right, so look. Geezer Butler, when I have an aversion to talking to a musician, it's never because I don't like them necessarily. It's because I don't really feel like I know enough about them. And to be honest, there's so much music that I came to, you know, way late to the party. But I've said before that I don't really think there's such a thing as late to the party anymore, because everything is happening all the time. Everything's available to you. You can get involved with whatever you want. The work is there. Enjoy the work whenever. Just because you missed it when it happened doesn't mean you're late to the party. And I think I've been late to the party since the beginning of my music education or my interest in music or my connecting with music. I mean, by the time I was in high school, it was the mid-70s. And most of these bands that have become the heavy metal rock pantheon were all sort of, you know, cranking it out in the, you know, late 60s to early 70s. Like, so their first three or four records it was already done. I mean, you know, by the time I was in high school, it was probably, you know, Dio was probably singing. So there, this music exists, but it exists in this sort of time vacuum. When I was coming alive in high school, I guess in the mid-70s, there was a lot going on with music, but a lot of the people and a lot of the bands that were powerful and big were old bands. There was a lot of weirdness, you know, going on, because disco was sort of not on its way out. It had done its thing, and then, you know, it kind of broke apart, and some of the punk movement and new wave music and the new wave stuff was pushing back on disco. There was a lot of stuff going on in England that none of us knew about. You know, it was really just ZZ Top, Led Zeppelin, Ted Nugent. There was a few Sabbath guys, and there was a few guys that were on the cutting edge of what was going on with punk. There was some new wave stuff, some Skinny Ties, a lot of Buttons, a lot of stuff coming back around. I mean, who did I see? I saw a lot of concerts, but I don't know. It really depends who you were hanging out with. My buddy Dave was a Deep Purple guy. He loved Richie Blackmore. My buddy Chris was sort of the more artsy, you know, I don't know, more off the grid guy. He was like into Zappa, the Kinks. He's the first guy that turned us on to the Cars. All that stuff was happening when I was in high school. And I was hanging out with the guy, the older guy who worked at the record store next door, who was turning me on to Brian Eno, Fred Frith, the Residents, you know, David Bowie. I had a box of records that I had gotten from the record store. They were primarily an R&B shop, so I got a lot of records. That must have been in the mid-70s. It was like Tom Waits, Nighthawks at the Diner, Elvis Costello's first record, George Thorogood. It's a random bunch of stuff that kind of defined my musical sort of interests. But I don't remember ever enjoying a concert as much as I did when I drove out to the Golden Inn, which was a biker bar between Albuquerque and Santa Fe, which later burned down, to see the Fabulous Thunderbirds. I mean, that must have been towards the end of high school. I don't know when that album, there was a point there where I was buying vintage suits, and I had the shark skin, I had the shiny suit, swicked my hair up, went out there and listened to Jimmy Vaughn and the Fellas. And it's just a total mix of influences and people I was around. I do remember when Zeppelin 1 came out, because it was weird. It was around the same time as the first Dire Straits album came out, wasn't it? And both of those were kind of like, what is happening here? But yeah, when Van Halen 1 came out, that just changed the fabric of everything. All this to say is that I wasn't that big of a follower ever. And it seems to me that metal in general is a type of music that has truly loyal, diehard fans that are so immersed in it. I don't know where my adolescent male energy was going at that point. I think it was a little, it was a little fragmented, bit of a spectrum, a lot of interest, but I was never the type of person. And look, I love the Stones, but even that, it's limited. I had that Stones, what was that, double greatest hits album with the castle on the cover. I had that stuff, but I didn't have this loyalty. The music of a particular band was never my sort of outlet for anger, frustration, discomfort, fury. I mean, I could listen to music and feel relieved and get off on it, but it seems like the type of fan that locks into metal or into the beginnings of metal, it's just it's a specific guy. And you got to be that guy to really kind of be deep in it. And I was never that guy. I don't think I really grew to appreciate Sabbath until I was in my 40s. All this to say is that, you know, dealing with, you know, Geezer is like, I think most of my best interviews with musicians are ones that I'm not coming to it as a total fanboy, but at least, you know, as somebody who has somewhat of an understanding of why the music is good. And I had that, and that's enough. And for Geezer, I read the book as well, and the story is spectacular. It's just like, it's one of these rock stories that it's just like, how the fuck did these guys stay alive? How did they stay determined to continue to make it when they came up in the UK and the touring and the insanity and Ozzy being insane and Tony with his fingers and his, like, you know, power trip. But when you're talking with a guy who really lived that, you're just sitting there going, like, how the fuck are you still alive? What is the magic? Can you imagine the type of unity you have to play the size and the type of gigs these guys are playing without just, you know, breaking apart, which arguably, you know, Ozzy, they've all, I think, broken apart a bit, but they've, you know, recontracted. They've brought it back together. But it was a great story, and it was certainly exciting in a way to sort of hear it firsthand, you know, after reading the book. Geezer's a very nice guy. You know, he's been a vegetarian for years. The book is called Into the Void, From Birth to Black Sabbath and Beyond. It's out in paperback. And we're gonna get into that story a bit right now with Geezer Butler.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
So I'll tell you, man, I read the whole book.
Oh, good.
The whole thing.
Great.
It's very honest, real feelings. Feels like you wrote the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You didn't sit there and tell the story to somebody else.
The only thing that somebody else did was like, what gigs we did when, and
you had to be reminded.
Yeah, they like yeah. Because I couldn't remember what gigs we did
and what dates
and what album, when the albums came out.
Yeah,
what numbers they got to and that kind of thing.
Just basic research.
Yeah,
yeah. I thought it was great. I think it's amazing. You're all still alive. I mean, it's really fucking amazing. Even with Ozzy being, you know, he's a little compromised, but still, it's amazing he's alive. And yeah. Bill's still alive?
Yeah, he's still alive.
Wow. Where's Tony?
He still lives in England.
Yeah?
But he had to get over cancer.
Yeah, yeah. So. But he's all right?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Now, do you stay in touch with everybody?
Occasionally. I haven't... Really, Bill's not on email, and I don't use the phone.
Mm.
So
he's out.
I message with Ozzy
all
the time.
He's here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And email Tony.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
I can't believe it. What do you think? And you're pretty healthy?
Yeah, apart from...
the allergies? Or,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I got tinnitus. Tinnitus.
Well, of course. How are you not going to have that?
Yeah.
I think that every musician... of any generation, if they tour enough, they're going to get that.
Yeah, especially us.
Yeah, standing in front of that bass amp.
Because I could never use the in-ears.
Yeah.
The wall's going, just use in-ears. No.
What are they? Earplugs?
Yeah, you put like...
Oh, the monitors.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In your ears.
Yeah.
But then there's nothing coming out behind you. It's all like through monitor desks.
You don't feel it.
No. And I like to really feel it. So I have my I think my bass is like 8,000 watts or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What kind are you playing now?
I'm Lakeland.
Oh, okay.
Lakeland bass.
What did you went through? You went through the Fenders and you had BC Rich for a while?
Yeah, I still like the Fenders. I collect old Fenders.
The P basses?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And jazz.
Yeah, the jazz basses. Yeah. What do you think is it, like, I've been a vegan for about a year and a half. And when I read some of the stories of the book of you trying to eat, like in the 60s and 70s, because you've been a vegan your whole life, it just sounded fucking terrible. I don't even know how you lived.
Oh, it's horrendous. I mean, I used to look about that thin.
Just because you just ate potatoes or yeah, whatever.
At one point, the pig food.
Yeah.
We were staying next to a pig farm. And they used to grow these turnips to give to the pigs.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely starving, so I got over the hedge, just dug up these turnips.
Didn't even cook them?
No, ate them raw.
Because you're literally starving.
Yeah.
And but now, when did you learn how to balance it? Because there's a trick to it, being a vegan, so you get everything you need, right?
Yeah, I'm never really... I mean, now it's easy because you've got different kinds of oat milk and soya milk.
And fake meats.
All the fake meats you can think of.
Do you take vitamin B12?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you have to, right? Because you can't get it anywhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Usually the injections of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How often?
I think once a month I have the
injections. Oh, that's a good idea. And that's all you need?
Yeah. I mean, I take, occasional vitamins.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because I have to figure, because, I mean, it seems like you're probably the healthiest out of the crew.
Yeah.
that it had something to do with the vegan thing. You?
Could be, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe just genetics?
I don't think so, because my three sisters just, died in the past 3 years, so.
Oh, yeah.
But they weren't vegans. They were,
they weren't?
No.
No. But I just, I've always gotten kind of fascinated with, you all grew up near each other?
Yeah, in Aston, in Birmingham, just like a little part of Birmingham.
And that was what was it like there? Like, was it just working class kind of?
Ultra working class.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was nobody had cars or anything like that.
Yeah.
And you go to the local school.
Right.
If you were Catholic, you went to the Catholic school. If you're Protestant, you went to the Protestant school.
And your family was pretty Catholic.
Yeah, they were all from Dublin.
Yeah. But it was tense, right, with Irish and English at that time or after?
Not so much Irish, because it was an immigrant area, so there was hardly any English people.
Mm.
Didn't really see many until I went to secondary school.
Yeah.
And the most tense was when the Jamaicans moved in, and the Pakistanis and Indians. And there used to be quite a lot of fighting between the Irish and the black people.
Sure. Well, I find it interesting, because I haven't talked to that many people, because I don't know Britain that well, but I've talked to guys... who grew up just, after the war. I talked to Daltrey, and there was I don't think people really realized just how devastated England was.
It was, it's still all bombed out where I was born.
Yeah, whole building's gone.
Yeah, and it was like our playground. That's where we used to go and play on the building site, the bomb building sites.
But you weren't alive yet with the bombing.
No.
But your dad and everybody else was, huh?
Dad, yeah. He was a auxiliary fireman during the war because he was too old for the army.
Yeah.
And, my mom had five little babies to look after while she was being bombed.
Yeah, so you were born already?
I was born in 1949, like 4 years after.
But the older siblings were in the house?
Yeah, they had to leave Aston because all the factories were in where we were born,
yeah.
In Birmingham. It's like all the aeroplanes were made there.
Oh, so they bombed it.
The tanks, all the engines for the... Birmingham is a big gun manufacturing city as well. So it got bombed to death.
Yeah.
So, and my sisters and brothers had to move out to the country on their own.
Yeah. Do you think that growing up post-war like that and just seeing it, even before the late 60s, had some sort of impact on the way you saw the world?
Absolutely, yeah. Because, my brothers were in the army.
They
were called up for national service. And my other brother was a complete Hitler fanatic.
It
sort of weird how that happens. I mean, I'm a Jewish guy, and I remember when I was a kid, you get fascinated with him for some reason.
He was, absolutely. He used to wear SS uniforms.
He just liked it. He wasn't a Nazi, but he just thought it was...
Oh, yeah. He went out and formed... He was one of the first members of the British National Party.
Oh, so he was. He was. Yeah. He believed in it.
Swastika tattoo.
Oh, my God.
The whole thing. We all thought he was nuts.
How long did he stick with that?
Well, my dad made him go back to the tattooist and have his swastika changed to a bunch of roses.
Did that really work?
It seemed to. And then he was like incredibly racist. So as where we were living in Aston, as it became more black and more Pakistanis and Jamaicans moved in, he said, I'm not staying here with these people. And he moved out to the country.
Did he stay racist?
I don't know. I haven't seen him for God knows how many years.
He's still around though?
I don't know. Nobody knows where he went.
Oh, really?
We've tried to get in touch with him, but...
Just disappeared?
Yeah.
Do you have any siblings left other than him?
I've got one brother left.
Oh, yeah?
And he's in a care home in England.
Oh, okay. So what fascinates me about England at that time is that, or a little later, I only talked to one guy, one other person, about skiffle.
Mm.
And that, like, and that was a whole new thing to me. Like, I think it was Daltrey who was telling me about it. But that was a thing, huh?
Absolutely, yeah. Lonnie Donegan was the big name.
Yeah.
The skiffle
and
thing.
It was sort of like jug band music.
Yeah, and the bass player had, like, this tea chest with a broom handle and a piece of string, and that was how he played bass.
And it worked?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what gave me inspiration to make my own guitar out of a plank of wood.
You made a guitar that worked?
Didn't work, no. It just looked to me like a guitar. To everybody else, it was a plank of wood with a stick on the end.
And tell me about these visions you had. How old were you?
Probably started when I was about 5.
Mm.
The whole thing started because we used to go to Dublin.
Family.
Yeah, grandma's house every other year. My dad used to save up his money to take us over there. And it was like the strange feeling in the house. And this one time, I could hear something creaking on the stairs. Me and my sister ran out and we just saw the apparition just like gliding down the stairs.
Yeah.
And just freaked us out.
Yeah, so you still have a little, do you still have a part of your brain that believes?
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
And the time when I was dreaming about me and Tony getting stuck in a lift.
Oh, that was a good one, yeah.
Yeah, and the lift, in the dream, we got in the lift, stopped halfway, and then we tried to open the door, and then the lift just dropped.
Yeah.
And before we were going to hit the bottom, I woke up, and then we were going to a gig and I told Tony about it. We got in the lift, the elevator.
Yeah.
And halfway down, it stopped. And we both went, oh, no.
This is it.
And it just started up again.
Well, thank God. But what about the visions of yourself in the future?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I used to be in the same bedroom as my dad. Because there was like 9 of us in this tiny little house. And there was this old fireplace. It's a Victorian house, 1873 it was built. And there was this old fireplace. And this one night, I felt this, like, an orb above my head.
Yeah.
And I looked into this orb, and it was sort of like a crystal ball kind of thing. And I saw this stage and this guy that was playing guitar.
Yeah.
And I always remember he had silver boots on.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the hell is this? Because there's no such thing as like rock and roll back then.
Right.
And this orb like sort of disappeared, went up back in the chimney.
Yeah.
And I didn't think anything of it until I told my mum and dad about it.
Yeah.
It's just a nightmare that you were having. And then, of course, it came true.
You had silver boots?
Yeah.
So you were there and awake and alive and conscious when rock and roll started, really?
Yeah, I mean, Elvis and Eddie Cochran.
And who did you like? When did you know you were going to play music?
As soon as the Beatles came out. It was like, I always remember one night, because rock and roll or pop music wasn't played on the radio in England. It was all this horrible junk that they used to play.
Yeah.
And so the only way you could listen to pop music was tune into Radio Luxembourg,
yeah,
which was a British station, but you couldn't have a British radio station playing pop music in England. So yeah, they had to move out to Europe. And they used to play all this pop music. And then this one night I was listening to it, and the Beatles came on. And I was just like, what the hell is this?
Yeah.
And that was it.
Right away you could feel that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, this is what I want to do.
But you didn't know how to go about it.
Well, I was 11 at the time. So.
Yeah. So when did you get an instrument?
It just so happened that there was a kid at the school that I was going to. He had this acoustic guitar with two strings on it. And I says, how much do you want for your guitar? And he said, 10 shillings, which is like 50 cents or something.
Yeah.
75 cents. And of course, I didn't have 75 cents. So I told my brother about it. And he says, yeah, here's the money for it.
Yeah.
So I bought it and I taught myself all the Beatles songs on these two strings.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't make chords because there wasn't enough strings.
And you couldn't afford strings?
Nope. And I eventually, I got really good on it. And my brother used to bring his friends in
to watch you?
To watch me play the Beatles songs, yeah, on two strings. And they go, oh, he's great. He, yeah, is. So my other brother gave me the money to get a proper six-string guitar.
Yeah.
And from then on, I started learning chords and stuff.
But the music was pretty much just the pop music.
Oh, yeah, back then, yeah.
Yeah, and when does it like, because what I like about England is that there are periods in the music history where everyone's sort of around. John Mayall and Fleetwood Mac and the bands from the generation before you. And you could see them. You could go see them perform.
Yeah, well, I went to see the Beatles and I went to the Stones.
You saw the Beatles?
Yeah.
Was it mind-blowing?
You couldn't hear them because all the screaming girls.
It was that much, huh?
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I only got the ticket because the mother of this girl that I was seeing was the manager of the place where they were playing. So
yeah,
she got me this ticket for free.
But it didn't matter. You couldn't hear them.
Couldn't hear them, but it was just like you're in the presence of the Beatles, and yeah, I was a Beatle fanatic.
Yeah, and to see the effect they had must have been something.
Oh, yeah, it's incredible.
It must have been crazy. And you saw the Stones?
Saw the Stones. They're on tour with Ike and Tina Turner.
Oh, yeah.
And nobody knew anything about Ike and Tina Turner. And
yeah.
She came out, and it was like, what the hell?
Yeah.
It was incredible.
I bet. The whole review.
Yeah, the whole thing. Ike there. The,
yeah.
The Ikeettes.
Yeah.
Dancing. Nobody had ever seen anything like that before.
Did they give the Stones a run for their money?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
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 And how were the Stones at that point?
Great. They were sort of vying for my favourite band at the time. It was like either, I was like the Beatles one week and then the Stones the next week.
And was it mid-60s?
Yeah, 65.
Did you see 60. Peter Green?
Yeah.
Yeah.
With Fleetwood Mac originally.
I think he's amazing.
He is. Well, I knew Christine Perfect.
Oh, yeah. And, who became Christine McVie?
Yeah. And I went to see Fleetwood Mac with the original Peter Green.
Because she was married to McVie at the time?
Yeah, but yeah, I didn't know that. And
right,
I was saying Eric Clapton's the best guitarist.
Yeah.
And she was saying, nah, Peter Green's the best guitarist.
Oh, she thought that.
Yeah.
I think he was better. I think Peter was better.
More soulful, I think.
Yeah, and definitely more like, you know, his version, because you saw Duster Bennett too, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That song, Jumping at Shadows, you know, that Peter covered, was like crazy.
Mm.
It was live somewhere in America. I have the recording of it. I'm just kind of fascinated with that guy because you get kind of fascinated with guys who lose their minds, but it seems like you were surrounded by them.
It was quite sad the way he went, Peter Green, because, you know, he lost his mind literally.
Yeah.
And wouldn't have anything to do with any royalties.
Yeah.
And he became a grave digger.
Yeah. And then somebody found him, I thought, in an institution or somewhere, all medicated.
Yeah, and
resurrected him.
They got together a few, about 10 years ago or something.
Yeah.
And, of course, he was on the way out by then.
Yeah, yeah, and you can't recapture whatever you had at the beginning.
Nah.
No. Yeah. So when did you see Hendrix too?
Yeah, I saw Hendrix three times.
Was that amazing?
First time was incredible. It's just like, what the? And then the last time, it took about like half an hour to tune up.
Oh, really?
It's like everybody's going, what's going on?
Yeah.
Miles out of tune, he's playing. But it's still like, what's Jimi Hendrix?
Yeah. So when do you guys start playing together?
We started in 1968.
And it was like, it was a straight up blues band?
Yeah.
That's just what people did.
Yeah, it was like, because John Mayall was like massive at the time with Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
And so everybody sort of going in that direction.
And who'd you meet first?
Out of what? The band?
The band, yeah.
Ozzy.
Yeah. I love, there's a couple of moments in the book that so perfectly kind of capture his insanity. I mean, I think it's like you had seen him around town.
Yeah, well, I used to pass his school on the way to Catholic school. There was a Protestant school where he was.
Yeah.
And like, you know, you just walk to school.
Right. Yeah.
From when you were five, you just.
Yeah.
And it was always like the battle between the Catholics and the Protestants. So you'd walk past their school and you'd have to scrap your way to your school.
Right.
And
right.
Then eventually, Ozzy lived right across the. His house is right across the road from the church I used to go to.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And eventually, I saw it because when he grew older, he became like a mod. That's what we used to call
them.
Mods and rockers.
Yeah.
And they used to have all these all night gigs in Birmingham at the time.
Yeah.
And you go there, you take loads of black bombers and stuff.
Speed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And stay up all night. And then it finished like about 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
And I'd walk home. And on the other side of the road, Ozzy was walking home. We used to just like waver each other.
But he wasn't in a band yet, right?
I don't think so, no.
And how'd you end up getting him to play music with you?
Well, we were looking, I was in a band called The Rare Breed.
Yeah.
Formed that with the kid that I went to school with.
Yeah.
And the singer at the time, he got a job on this cruiser to Australia, like singing.
Yeah.
They actually paid him money.
Right.
And it was like, what are you getting? And so we were looking for a singer for the band. And we went to the music shop in Birmingham. And there was this, it's like where musicians used to advertise. And I saw this note saying, Ozzy Zig needs a gig.
Yeah.
Call, put his address on, which is, and I went, oh, that's right there around the corner from where I live.
Yeah.
So I went round to his house, and of course he wasn't in, but his sister opened the door, and I says, I'm answering the advert that Ozzy Zig put in, and I told him where I lived.
Yeah.
Then later that night, there was a knock on the door, and my brother got up to open the door, and he came in, and he went, hey, there's something at the door for you. I'm like, what do you mean there's something? He says, go and have a look.
Yeah.
And I went to the door, opened the door, and there was Ozzy with skinhead.
Yeah.
With a shoe over his shoulder. A chimney brush over his shoulder.
Right.
A sneaker on a dog lead.
Yeah.
No shoes on, and his dad's work gown on. I've heard you're looking for a singer, and I said, what kind of stuff do you do? And he says, whatever you want to do.
Yeah.
And he says, but I've got my own PA system. And I went, okay, you're in.
That was it.
And then we did.
Did you think he was a skinhead at first?
Yeah. And he says, I'll grow my hair, don't worry. And so we did like 2 or 3 gigs, and it was, we used to get thrown off everywhere we were playing.
Why?
It must have been crap. And the final gig, this guy comes up. He goes to Ozzy, here's, get off. Here's £5 now, piss off. And Ozzy went, you can stick it up your ass, the £5. And I went, I'll have the £5. I've got to pay the gas for the truck.
Yeah.
And so then we left that band, and we both, we were looking around for other guitarists.
Yeah.
Oh, no, a drummer at the time. Ozzy had got his friend who was a slide guitar player. So we were going to form a band with the slide guitar player.
Yeah.
and this saxophonist.
What happened?
So
a sax guy.
But meanwhile, Tony and Bill were in a band up in up the north of England.
Yeah.
And they got busted for drugs, so they had to come back to Birmingham. And Ozzy says, I know a guy that I used to go to school with called Tony Iommi. He's just been done for drugs.
Yeah.
But I think he knows a drummer. I think he's back. So we went round to Tony's house, which is literally three streets away.
Yeah.
We said to Tony, is Bill Ward there? Is that your drummer? And he went, yeah, he's here at the shop right now. So Bill came out.
What kind of shop?
His mom had like a pop and sweets and that kind of stuff, bread. And so Bill came out. He says, well, I'll join your band, but Tony's got to come with me. And he says, well, we've already got a guitarist. He went, well, he's got to come with me, and that's it.
Yeah.
So he said, okay, we'll try that. And then that's the way we started.
That's crazy. So you had Bill and Tony and you and Ozzy, a slide guitarist and a saxophone player.
The saxophone player could only play Take Five. But he played it really good. So when I first seen him, what does he do? Is he any good? And he'd do like a great rendition of Take Five.
Yeah.
But we didn't know that's the only thing he could play.
Yeah. So how'd you get rid of those guys?
The first gig, because Tony and Bill, our very first gig was back up in Carlisle where Tony and Bill had been busted. But they'd built up quite a following up there.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. So we went up there in the bloody van. Took ages to get up there. And we did the gig. And like people were going, boo, to me and Ozzy and the sax player and the sleigh. You're crap, get off. And but you're good to Tony and Bill. Yeah. So at the end of the gig, we finish, and all these Tony and Bill's fans come to me. You're crap, and that singer's crap, and that sax player's crap. And that, but Tony and Bill are good, so I think you should just all piss off.
Yeah.
So great. And as we were loading the van up, these two bloody great big Irish blokes came up. Started accusing us of trying to get off with their girlfriends. And we said, you haven't got any girlfriends? And well, we might have.
Yeah.
So he started trying to beat us all up. So the police came with this German Shepherd dog, canine thing. The guy strangles the dog. And,
oh, my God.
I think there was like three police cars there. Get these two guys in the cop, take them to jail.
Yeah.
And he broke out of jail. And that was our first show.
What did he do when he got out of jail? Come looking for you?
No. Yeah. Never seen him again.
Yeah, you do get into a lot of fights.
Yeah.
You were all pretty fighty.
Well, there was a lot of skinheads around when we were doing in England, in the mid-60s, it was mods and rockers. The mods were like the Who, followed the Who. And the rockers were like, followed the blues and male and cream and that thing.
Yeah.
So that became skinheads against hippies. And then the hippies became greasers. That's what they used to call us.
Huh.
And some of the gigs, you'd have all the skinheads waiting for us outside.
And they were just gangs? They didn't have any particular, it was just based on music?
Based on what length of your hair.
Oh, that was
so
it.
If you had long hair, they'd kick hell out of you.
Yeah. So you had a fight.
Oh, yeah.
And Tony liked to fight.
Tony loved to fight, yeah.
But that sound, like, you know, the evolution of, like, the Sabbath sound had so much to do with the fact that his fingers were fucked up, right?
Absolutely. And to this day, I just do not know how he does it. I really don't.
Does it cause him pain every time he plays?
No, because he wears these thimbles that look like... Eventually, when he had enough money, he had like proper like thimbles that looked like fingers put on his. But I still can't understand how he could feel the strings.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So when do you guys start like playing a Sabbath?
We turned up, we were called Polka Talk for our first gig. Polka Talk.
Yeah.
It's the name of an Indian sari shop.
Okay.
Because we were going to our first gig and we went, we haven't got a name.
Right. Yeah.
So we passed this Indian sari shop, and Ozzy went, oh, look, Polka Talk. It's calling ourselves Polka Talk Blues Band.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. And we got to, did the first gig, and we went, got to come up with a better name.
And you were playing just blues covers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, all blues covers. And some Cream.
Oh, yeah.
And what's his name? Ainsley Dunbar stuff.
Okay.
All the established British blues bands.
Yeah.
Playing some of their stuff.
Yeah.
Robert Johnson, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we said, we've got to come up with a better name than Polka Talk Blues Band. And Bill says, what about Earth? And we like that. So went with that. And then mid-'69, we turned up at this gig. And it's all like a wedding reception.
Yeah.
Like all the women had nice dresses on. The blokes had suits.
Yeah.
It's a weird crowd for us. Yeah. So we went on, played the first song, and they're like going, they all got up to dance, and they're like looking at us as if we'd nuts. So second song, and this guy comes up, no, stop. What's the matter? He says, you're not playing your single. I mean, what single? We haven't got a single out. And he went, you know, your single, your Earth single. And it was a totally different band.
Another band called Earth. Yeah.
Yeah. So on the way home, they says, what can we call us, the band? I says, well, we just wrote that song called Black Sabbath. Let's just go with that.
What was where'd you find that title for that?
There was a horror film called Black Sabbath.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
out in 1964.
Yeah.
And I was too young to see it, because you had to be 16 to go and see horror films back then. And my brother loved it. He said, I've just seen a great film called Black Sabbath. And it's stuck in my mind.
Yeah.
And later, I just thought, that would be a great name for a band.
Yeah. Did you ever see the movie?
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's terrible.
I think what's interesting, too, like in going over this stuff, is that your eventual kind of resentment of prog rockers, a lot of them, is sort of like what's interesting is that, you know, I think what changed your sound and what began to define the Sabbath sound was actually a King Crimson show, right?
Yeah. I went to see, I really like King Crimson. I went to see them live.
Yeah.
And they did a version of Holt's The Planet Suite, and they played Mars.
Yeah.
And it was like, dun, dun, dun. And I was playing it on my bass the next day when we were rehearsing.
You went and bought the record?
Oh, yeah. I loved the album.
Yeah.
That was like my favorite music at the time. And I was playing the bass, trying to play Mars on the bass. And Tony went, he just came up with the riff for Black Sabbath because it sounded similar.
But there's also that construction, that sort of thing that happens in that music. What do you call them? Tri something?
A tritone.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's a big shift away from blues.
Absolutely, yeah. Because the whole thing started was when Tony joined Jethro Tull and for one gig.
Yeah.
And he came back and says, look, we've got to start writing our own music, otherwise we're just never going to get anywhere. We're just be playing like blues music for the rest of our lives in pubs.
Yeah.
And then when blues goes out of fashion, that's it.
We
won't be doing anything. So we've got to come up with our own sound.
Yeah.
And Black Sabbath is the first, second song. Wicked World was the first song. Black Sabbath was the second.
And that's where you realized you were onto something sound-wise.
Yeah. I always remember it. We used to play this little pub in just outside Birmingham.
Yeah.
And we'd done our set, and the crowd were like, just like indifferent. They'd seen us a million times,
right?
And we said, let's play that song that we just wrote today, which is Black Sabbath.
Yeah,
and we played it, and the place just went wild
because they'd never heard anything like it.
No, and we went, that's it.
We figured it out, and it was different too, from because hard rock was sort of happening, right?
Zeppelin was massive at the time.
Did you like them?
Yeah, I love Zeppelin because they were local as well.
Yeah.
Plant in Bonham.
Yeah, I mean, and Bonham was kind of crazy on the drums.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we could hear. He used to play the all-nighters that I used to go to.
Oh, he did?
Him and Plant with, what were they called? I can't remember what his first band was called, but and you could hear Bonham. You'd like get off the bus like a mile away. You could hear him drumming.
And you got to know him, right?
Yeah, he became. He was Tony's best man at Tony's wedding.
Oh, really?
And he used to come round to my house. I went round to his house this one time because he was great when he was straight.
Yeah,
he was like the worst person on earth when he was drunk.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I went round to his house and he was actually straight. And he says, I just got this great drum riff that I put down. We're doing this new album. And it was When the Levee Breaks.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, and that was, so their first album was big.
Massive.
But it's still like, it's not, I guess they kind of broke it open, but nobody sounded like you.
We were more raw, I think.
Yeah.
Because they were established session. Well, Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones were established session musicians.
Yeah.
You know, they structure it more.
Maybe you guys were just winging it. You had to figure it out for yourself. I guess there's something to that, to figuring it all out for yourself. Then you're uniquely you.
Absolutely. I mean, none of us ever went to college or anything like that, music college or
sure.
That. We just taught ourselves.
But you went, did you go to college?
I went to a day college. You go twice a week.
Right.
And I never turned up because it was a bus ride and I was terrible at getting up in the morning. So I missed all the day ones.
But you did, you had some kind of thing in your head because you did a lot of the songs and they were all kind of literary and referenced in.
Well, I used to really like English literature and English language.
Yeah.
And for some reason.
Yeah.
And I was good at it. So that's when we came to writing lyrics, it was up to me to write the lyrics.
And when did this sort of idea, because I noticed when you read the book that you never saw yourself as initially, when did you sort of realize or accept that you guys invented something?
Well, they kept calling us heavy metal, and it was a derogatory term at the time.
From a critic?
Yeah. I always remember we were in America at the time, and I think we'd done two gigs in this same city. We were looking at the reviews the next day, and this guy said, "This isn't music. It just sounds like a lot of heavy metal being smashed together." And I thought, oh, great, that's nice.
Yeah.
And by the time we got back to England, the papers, the music papers over there had picked up on the heavy metal thing.
Yeah.
So they started classing our music
as heavy metal.
And it was derogatory at the time, but then...
After the first album or second album?
I think it was probably the second album.
Yeah. And then it became a thing.
Yeah. We hated it. We always wanted to be known as a heavy rock band.
Hard rock.
Yeah. Hard rock band.
Yeah. I mean, that those conversations still happen. The difference between hard rock and heavy metal.
Yeah. Ozzy is never, ever.
He won't call it heavy metal.
Call it heavy metal.
Why does it bother him so much?
Because of the derogatory nature.
Oh, it stuck with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, those Ozzy stories. The other moment in the book where, he's just wearing a faucet around his neck.
Yeah, when we played the Marquee, which is the most prestigious club in London, in England at the time.
Yeah.
And the guy that owned it, John G.
Yeah.
It was like everything had to be perfect for him.
Yeah.
And Alvin Lee from 10 Years After.
Yeah.
He liked 10 Years After. That was his favourite, modern band, John G, because he was a big jazz bloke.
Yeah.
So Alvin Lee convinced him to give us a go at the Marquee Club.
Yeah.
And he says, but try and dress up a bit. You can't wear what you're wearing now because he's really weird about things like that. So we get to the club. I go in first because I was fairly fashionable.
Yeah.
Then Tony and then Bill. And he's like going, what are you dressed as?
Yeah.
And then Ozzy comes in with a pyjama jacket on and the top of a faucet round his neck. And he went absolutely mental for John G. And
how was the gig?
It was great.
Yeah?
Yeah, gig was great.
But it's just like, it just seems like Ozzy's just got this thing where, you know, he's just like that, huh?
Yeah, well, that time in Denmark, when we had our first gig in Europe, and we had our clothes and stuff to take, Ozzy comes out with it, one shirt on a coat hanger for 6 weeks.
But you guys didn't, you know, I mean, there. I know there's a, you know, in the story, there was a period there where, you know, you were sort of trying to be within the hippie thing, but it didn't, it seems like what launched the whole tone of Sabbath was, you know, against that in terms of like looking at the realities of what you grew up in.
Yeah. I mean, the Vietnam War was massive at the time, and we were seeing things in England that were coming out about what America was doing that were never shown in America.
Yeah.
So it was sort of, we were seeing the other side of it, kind of
thing. Yeah.
And when it came to writing, my brothers had been in the army, my dad had been in the army for 12 years.
Yeah.
And we just didn't want to be dragged into the Vietnam War, so a lot of the lyrics were against war.
And that, like, on the second record?
Yeah, War Pigs.
You talked to somebody who had been in Vietnam, right?
We used to play, when we were playing in Germany, there was a big American army base. And what it was, when they'd finished, when the soldiers were finished in Vietnam, when they were being sent home, they'd have to go to this base to, like, come down from the war before they went home, you know, to America.
Right.
They used to tell us horrible things about what was going on there. And it just stuck in my mind, you know. Nobody knows the horrors that's going on.
Sure.
And that's where War Pigs
came in.
Yeah.
And that was a huge song.
It is, yeah. It still is.
It's huge. And it's like, it's been covered by a lot of people, but it's interesting that, you know, that it's founded in that. And you kind of clear up some stuff in the book about, you know, what people think the songs are about and what they're really about. You know, some people have created whole mythologies around songs, you know, like Iron Man.
Yeah.
That, I don't know what people assume it's about, but what you say it's about is different.
It was based on the story of Jesus going into, going for his crucifixion.
Yeah.
It's like he goes in as a hero on a donkey into Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, yeah.
And the next week,
he's
crucified. You know, and it was like Iron Man was like, had gone, shot into space, saw the future of the world, came back to tell everyone, but on the way back, he got stuck in this atomic storm.
Yeah.
And was turned to iron, and people just were taking the piss out of him all the time. And then eventually, he comes to life and gets revenge on them.
So it's like Super Jesus.
With not the same intent.
But also, like, you know, from very early on, people aligned you with Satanism.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it was
probably Black Sabbath. The name had something to do with it.
But Satanism was always this, like, ridiculous thing. You know, even, you know, in terms of, like, that Anton LaVey prank, the publicity prank that happened in San Francisco. Yeah. They were a bunch of clowns, really, the Satanists.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was a big thing in England in like 68.
Oh, because everyone was into Crowley.
Crowley. The Beatles were doing the Maharishi thing.
Yeah, not quite Satanism.
And all we knew was like Catholics or Protestants. And then suddenly the Beatles were like in India doing this other thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of Pakistanis were Muslims that were coming to where we lived.
Sure.
And there's all these different religions that we didn't really know anything about, and including Satanism.
Yeah. Well, it's not even a real religion.
But there was a lot of big interest in the horror films at the time.
And they would show up at the shows?
The Christians would. Oh, yeah. And the Satanists. Yeah. When they turned up at, I think when one of them tried to sacrifice us, he jumped on stage to stab Tony.
Yeah.
Right at the same time that Tony's amp blew up, and Tony walked off with this guy with a knife.
Yeah.
About to stab him.
Yeah.
One of the roadies got him.
Yeah.
And that night at the hotel, we heard all this commotion out in the corridor of our rooms.
Yeah.
And what the hell's going on there?
Yeah.
So looked out and there's this like coven. Or
like a witch red. Coven?
Yeah, yeah, witch coven with all the black candles.
In the hallway?
Yeah, in the hallway of the hotel.
Yeah.
And a tour manager went out and he went, hey, come here, do you want to know a secret about Sabbath? And they all went, yeah, what? Tell us what it is. And he went, blew out all the candles and went, happy birthday to you. Now fuck off.
That was the end of that. But it kind of hung over you for a while, right? The darkness.
Oh, yeah, still in... I remember in even when we did the much later on, we played in Austria.
Yeah.
And this was like in the year 2000 or something. We had this post, the album cover was an angel with its wings on fire.
Right, yeah.
And put the poster up in this ultra Catholic place.
Yeah.
And the bishop of the place went absolutely mental. So he had all the posters changed from it was a crocodile eating the angel to cover the wings on fire.
What?
And Tony Martin says, well, what's worse, an angel with the wings on fire or being eaten by a crocodile? And I always remember the first time we played Salt Lake City, there was like the guys with the Bibles.
Yeah.
Praying with the Bibles all throughout our gig.
Oh, my God. But I mean, it seems like it only added to the mystique, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't hurt you.
Certainly didn't.
Yeah. And the Master of Reality album, that's another one where people assume they know that the title implies something. But in the book, you're like, no, it doesn't. You just came up with it from what the master recording.
Yeah, it was the master recording and the lyrics were all about reality.
Yeah.
And that's how it got the name.
It's very funny when you kind of like the truth happens. When you know you're able to sort of demystify all this stuff.
I think the worst was Paranoid, when they said that Paranoid ends with, and so I tell you to enjoy life before it's too late.
Yeah.
And Don Arden went on this talk show and he said, it's Sabbath, like, fancy, they can't say, actually say in one of the songs, Paranoid, I tell you to end your life.
Yeah.
Instead of enjoy, and the real lyrics were enjoy life.
Was that when Don Arden was mad at you?
Yeah, because we didn't go with his management.
The stories about you guys, like, you were just so happy to be playing and working, but you were being ripped off for years.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't even know how you, like, thank God you figured it out.
Well, because he'd phone the manager up, says, well, I want to buy a new car. And you'd get the money for the new car. But that's all you'd get. You weren't allowed to have, like, X amount of money in the bank.
And you had no recourse for it because you just thought that was the way it was?
Well, he always says, don't worry. At the end of it, you will all be, like, rich and all this kind of crap.
This was the first manager?
The second manager, Patrick Meehan.
What was the first manager?
Jim Simpson.
Who were the gangsters?
Well, first Don Arden and then Patrick Meehan.
Yeah.
And Wilf Pine was...
Wilf Pine, that guy.
Yeah, he was like associated with the Pagano family in New York.
And he worked for the Krays too?
Worked for the Krays, yeah. He was like their...
Scary guy.
Yeah. But he was... we never really knew about the mafia connection.
You didn't until later?
Didn't know anything until much later.
It just seems like there was a group of guys, like Arden's kind of notorious.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he's Ozzy's wife's father.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I didn't know about all that stuff between them eventually, that they had a falling out.
Yeah, for like about 15, 20 years.
Did they ever resolve it?
They resolved it when he got dementia.
Oh.
And she just felt sorry for him.
She let it go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he was kind of notorious. My buddy is in music management, John Daniel. And, you know, he used to, you know, Arden just took a liking to him. So he, you know, he used to talk to that guy all the time. And he was a real a mythic kind of powerhouse.
Yeah. Well, when he tried to, had Robert Stigwood hung upside down outside his office window.
Yeah.
That was Wilf Pine.
Yeah.
It was hanging him upside down.
Yeah.
And
which band was he in?
Who?
Stigwood.
Got Bee Gees.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of Tom Jones. All those.
Oh, he had all those guys.
Yeah.
But you guys were charting and not making any money from it.
Just, we had a nice house.
Yeah.
And we had a nice cars.
Yeah.
But, and we were allowed, I think it was about $1,000
in
the bank, and that's all it could ever be.
And you're selling millions of records.
Millions of records, selling every gig we could play out.
And was this by the time, like Master of Reality?
Oh, yeah, right until the end, yeah. Right until the end.
When did it start? When did you start to sell out?
Probably after Paranoid.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And you built this whole fan base.
Yeah, massive, all over the world.
Yeah. Mostly dudes?
Yeah, unfortunately. Until Van Halen was with us.
Yeah, then it turned around a little bit.
For them, yeah. Going, oh, God, there's loads of women in the audience. I wonder why.
Yeah.
And then you go out and you see Dave Lee Roth and Eddie Van Halen. You're, oh.
Cute. Yeah, it was a little more upbeat.
Mm.
Yeah, it was like pretty poppy.
And they had all the videos as well on MTV. So yeah. We'd never really heard of
it. But do you think you built a new fan base then? You brought some different people in after Van Halen?
No.
I always thought, like, you know, I came into Sabbath, like, later. Like, I came into Sabbath when I was in my 30s or 40s and, like, listening. And I always thought, like, I was always a big Volume 4 fan. Like, I love that fucking record. And if you say that to, like, you know, like, diehard Sabbath fans, they're like, go fuck yourself. Someone said to me that Ozzy doesn't even remember doing that record. But you talk pretty highly of it.
It was when we started to change from the ultra-heavy stuff and the get more musical. Because we thought, you know, you can't just keep churning out the same thing album after album.
Yeah.
And I think we actually had more time to write. And so we started expanding the musical direction.
Yeah.
And some people liked it, some people didn't. Because the sales weren't as much as the third album.
They wanted the heavy stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also you talk about how Sweet Leaf isn't about pot.
Well, the lyrics are about pot.
Yeah.
But the idea came from these cigarettes in Ireland. I'd just come back from Ireland.
Yeah.
And they had these cigarettes called Sweet Afton. And I always thought, for some reason, it said Sweet Leaf.
Yeah. that was where it came from.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. There's like one piece, I don't know if it's Into the Void or not, but like how much influence did Zappa have on you guys?
I used to love Mothers of Invention when I was a teenager. And it was a couple of, I mean, the rest of the band weren't really into Zappa or anything.
Right, oh no.
I love the Mothers. I love the fact that, because at the time it was all like, oh, she's in love with me, or oh, I've just broke up with my girlfriend. That was kind of lyrics.
Yeah.
Zappa's lyrics were like totally different to everybody else. It was like, we are the brain police and all that kind of stuff.
So it's just
anti-establishment.
Inspiring.
Yeah.
Because I think Tony, sometimes when he goes off, I mean, Zappa used to do that too, just for hours.
Well, we found out that Zappa was a Sabbath fan.
Yeah. Well, why wouldn't he be? You guys are like, in some ways, the way you change up rhythms and, you know, half the songs, you know, it was sort of kind of musically different. And, you know, like, he likes to do that. Shift it up.
Yeah, yeah. But, like, at the time, a lot of the music journalists, like Zappa was like elite kind of thing.
Sure.
Sabbath were like gutter snipe. and they couldn't believe that Zappa liked Sabbath. And
so that help you out?
Yeah, he used to play Iron Man in his set.
Oh, yeah? Did he do a good version of it?
Yeah. And Supernaut. He thought Supernaut was the best riff he's ever heard.
It's a great riff. That's on 4, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you met him eventually, right?
Oh, yeah. At his, his birthday, which is mental.
When was that? How old was you? Was it in the 70s?
About 75. And he'd come to the gig. He invited us to his birthday party club.
Yeah.
And we went in and he had this birthday cake shaped like a vagina.
Yeah.
With all this champagne, like pissing out of it.
Yeah.
And we thought, God, this is weird. And then these three models came in, gorgeous models.
Yeah.
Completely naked, did a handstand against the wall, and he went pouring champagne down the women's bits.
That was a new level for you?
It certainly opened my eyes. Yeah.
To what? Like the possibilities of debauchery?
Just, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And like when? At what point do you guys start fighting? Right at the beginning?
No, not at the beginning. I mean, Ozzy was always a bit scared of Tony because Tony had he was the school bully when he was at school.
From when he was a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he had this respect for him kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until we started getting like really badly into drugs and stuff and booze.
That the ego started to?
Mainly Ozzy and Bill used to start killing each other.
Yeah, what was this thing where everyone was setting Bill on fire?
That was Tony's thing, because Bill had a big beard by then.
Yeah.
And Tony used to say, can I set your beard on fire, Bill?
Yeah.
He'd go, okay. So he'd set it off, and Bill would like go, breathing the fumes from his beard.
Yeah.
And then one day, when we were mixing the Heaven and Hell album in London, Tony said, Bill was just about to leave, and Tony went, oh, I haven't set your beard on fire for a long time. Can I do it now? And Bill went, no, I'm leaving. I've got to get back to the Midlands.
Yeah.
So about 2 minutes later, Bill comes back in. Okay, you can do it.
That's crazy.
So Tony gets this, lights his beard.
Yeah.
And throws all this inflammable liquid that they used to clean the recording desk up with. And Bill just goes up in total flames. And we realised how serious it was. And he's like, it's all over him. He's totally on fire. He's rolling around the floor. We were getting newspapers instead of cloth.
Yeah.
We were putting newspapers. It made it even worse.
Yeah.
And, of course, he had to straight to hospital. His trousers had melted into his legs.
Oh, my God.
And his socks had melted into his legs.
Oh, my God.
God knows how he survived it.
Did he forgive him?
Yeah. His mom didn't, though. She went absolutely mental.
Yeah, it sounds like Tony really liked to do some pretty painful pranks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did.
Which albums are you the most proud of?
Depends what mood I'm in. Probably Paranoid, Master of Reality.
Yeah, yeah. And by the time, like, when does it start to strain? You know, in terms of like Ozzy wanting to take off?
When we went on tour with, around the time the Van Halen tour started, because Tony brought in Albert Chapman as the tour manager.
Yeah.
And Albert Chapman was the one that used to beat hell out of Ozzy at school.
Another one?
Yeah. And he was Tony's best mate. So Ozzy just like,
wouldn't have it.
I don't want him in the, with us.
Yeah.
Tony insisted. So it sort of, that started it. And then we'd go on with Van Halen would go on and start copying Ozzy. Dave Lee Roth would say the same things as Ozzy. And they'd extend the solos like we were doing.
Yeah.
And
to upstage you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Tony had a word with Eddie this one night and told him to knock it on the head, which they did. But and Ozzy kept thinking he was intimidated by Dave Lee Roth because he kept saying the same things that Ozzy would say.
Yeah.
So when Ozzy went on, he'd feel daft saying the same thing.
Right.
And
it fucked with his head.
Yeah. But I think on the loads of booze and drugs and everything, he was getting like so out of it.
Yeah.
I remember when we were doing, I think it was the Sabotage album, we went into the bar and Ozzy was like collapsed on the floor in the bar. And Charlie Watts was in there because we used to play darts with him.
Yeah.
And Charlie Watts was like stepping over Ozzy kind of thing. I think your mates had too much to drink. And then eventually Ozzy just got so fed up of it. He left the band.
Yeah.
And went to form the Blizzard of Oz band.
Yeah.
And we got this other singer in that Tony liked, and it was just going right down the hill. So eventually, Ozzy came back to the band, and we did the album Never Say Die.
Yeah.
But it just wasn't working.
Really? Because there was too much tension?
We didn't have any money. We'd just been had to pay all the tax from the money that we'd never seen, because the inland revenue didn't believe us that we hadn't seen the money.
Yeah, that he'd been ripped off?
Yeah.
By the management?
So all that money that we'd been ripped off by, we had to pay the income tax on.
So much money.
And we were like literally broke at the time when we did Never Say Die.
So it was sort of like you had to do it just to sell some records.
Yeah.
How'd that one sell?
Not very well. And it was my least favorite album.
Yeah, why? Because everybody was so whacked?
He's whacked and just having been broke. We recorded it in Toronto in the middle of winter, and I got this cold in my ear.
Yeah.
So everything sounded like I was underwater.
Oh, my God.
And it just, we had to get up at 7 o'clock every morning to go down to the cheapest place we could find was a cinema,
yeah.
A theatre.
Yeah.
That would let us rehearse there before the people came in at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So
oh,
it was just horrible.
I mean, you guys are huge rock stars at this point.
Yeah. We'd had to pay so much. We had to pay Patrick Meehan £1 million just to get rid of him.
Oh.
So all our money, future money, that was from our future royalties that we had to pay him. So we didn't earn anything.
I can't even imagine that. How you guys, like, you must have been exhausted too. I mean, drugs, living like you guys were.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounded like you were just wasted.
And we were, yeah.
But, you know, I'd never really, like, give a real close listen to, you know, the Dio albums. And they're, like, you know, really good.
Dio revived us, yeah.
Because Ozzy was out. There was no getting him back.
Nah.
And Bill was gone, right?
No, Bill was with us when Dio came in.
Yeah.
But, because we'd been rehearsing with Ozzy, and he just didn't seem to be into it, and we were coming up with these songs, and Ozzy would go, "Nah, I don't like that." And we're going, "What are we going to do?"
Yeah.
And eventually Tony just said, "You know, we've got to part ways."
Was it emotional, these things?
Well, it's horrible. I was crying. Me and Bill were crying.
Yeah.
Because we knew that it had to happen.
Yeah.
And it was the best thing for Ozzy anyway, as it turned out. I mean, he became bigger than Sabbath.
Yeah.
But Ronnie came in. He listened to the stuff we were doing, and he came out with these vocals. Like, whoa, this is incredible.
Yeah. And you liked him?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, good guy.
Yeah, he was great.
But it's like, I guess, like, you were pretty clear in the book about how, you know, when a lot of people can't understand, you know, why bands break up necessarily. But when you frame it sort of like when you're with people every fucking day, you know, you're going to, it's going to start to wear on you.
It's true. It's like the first 2 weeks of a 2-year-old. Yeah, this is great.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And like fourth week.
But the ego thing, was it like, it seemed like Tony had a way of doing things.
Tony was the unspoken leader of the band.
Yeah.
He always had from day one.
Yeah.
And
you always, it was also what's interesting in the book is that like you guys, as the drugs wore on and everything else, I mean, you were literally waiting for Tony to come up with a riff.
By Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath.
Yeah.
We went back to California,
yeah,
which is where we did Volume 4 and loved the, you know, everything that went with it.
Yeah.
Big mansion and got up to all kinds of things. So let's go back there.
Yeah.
We came back, I think, about 2 or 3 weeks, and it was like we hadn't done anything.
Yeah.
And we were like all staring at Tony to come up with a riff.
Yeah.
And he was dry, just totally empty.
Oh, my God.
So we said, this isn't working.
So yeah.
It's either the end of the band.
Yeah.
I think if we can't come up with anything. So we all went back to England and we thought we'd give it one more try. We went to this castle in Wales and Tony came up with the riff for Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath. And,
wow.
And that was it.
You're back.
We're back, yeah.
It's a, that's like, you know, he's influenced so many people with that riff. I remember Soundgarden, that guy, Kim, well, I forget
Kim
his name.
Thrall.
Yeah, he was a huge Tony guy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He really was like, that's the way you play.
Even his SG.
Yeah, exactly. And Scott Ian, too, is like, you know, full Sabbath guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He's a good guy.
He is, yeah.
Yeah. And then, like, you know, I think, though, ultimately, though, whatever you thought of Metallica at the beginning, they ended up really being like a real Sabbath band, it seemed to me, in terms of how they thought about it.
Yeah, especially the Black Album.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a Sabbath album in terms of, like, you know, using those tritones and using, you know, stuff that is totally disconnected from blues into this kind of heavy sounding diabolical music.
Well, they supported Ozzy is one of his first solo tours, and Ozzy was walking past their dressing room.
Yeah.
They were playing Sabbath albums, and he thought they were taking the piss out of him. And he went to confront them, and they yeah. said, "No, no, we love Sabbath. We're not trying to, you know, take the piss out of it."
And he believed him eventually.
Yeah, and they were, you know, they're still good friends of ours.
Yeah, it's a heavy band, man. But so, what happened with Dio ultimately?
He sort of tried to take over Tony's part because Tony was always the leader, and then like me and Ronnie were like really close friends. We'd go to each other's house, get pissed together.
Yeah,
and it just got so that he wanted everything his way.
Yeah,
and he'd go on stage and he'd be going. Tony's too, and he'd be telling me that Tony's too loud, and I go, "Well, go and tell him then." He's like, "No, you tell him." He wouldn't confront Tony, and eventually it just like really drained me. I got sick of hearing about it, and I just couldn't talk to him anymore.
Yeah, just got to ego thing again.
Yeah, that was an ego thing. Yeah,
Mob Rules. Oh, that's a great album.
Great album. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And it's where we're living right now. You know what I mean? You listen to Fools, Mob Rules. It's like it's happening.
Yeah. I mean, he's great lyrics, Ronnie. But we did that, the actual song Mob Rules, at John Lennon's house.
For the movie.
Yeah.
So slightly different version.
Slightly different. Yeah, we could never get the same vibe when we did the album version.
Yeah, because that one's heavier, isn't it?
It was the whole thing felt better.
Because you were in the...
We were in Lennon's house.
Yeah.
We were on tour at the time, so we didn't have any our gear with us. And there was an old bass there, like an Italian thing that nobody's ever heard of.
The bass or the amp?
The amp.
Yeah.
And it had this great sound. Probably like about a $10 amp or something that nobody's ever heard of. And it just worked. The whole thing worked.
And you didn't want to steal the amp?
No.
And then you went through several different singers, you know, like those that after Dio.
Well, we did Ian Gillan from Deep Purple.
Yeah.
That was Don Arden's idea.
Yeah.
By this time, we'd gone back to Don Arden.
Yeah.
And as Ozzy said, go back to Don. He's doing great for me. You'll love him. So we went. His idea was getting Gillan in.
Yeah. And that was for Born Again?
Born Again, yeah.
That's so funny. There's that scene in the book where Ozzy shows up, you know, at your house again with a shaved head.
And this big, long, yellow gown on, like almost like the first meeting
exactly.
with him. And that's when he said, you go back with Don.
Yeah. You guys wore crosses that his dad made?
Yeah, when we got, because not Anton LaVey, like the chief... Wherever he was, Satanist in England.
Yeah. I don't know.
Invited us to the Witch's Sabbath.
Oh, yeah.
So we went, oh, piss off.
Yeah.
And he says, well, if you don't come, I'm going to curse you.
Yeah.
And this other guy that was on the white magic side said, you've got to wear crosses, otherwise this guy is serious. And of course, we all believed him.
Oh, no. When was that? Like after Paranoid or something?
Well, just as, no, first album.
Oh, first album, yeah.
And so Ozzy's dad made us all these. I mean, I had crosses anyway.
Yeah.
But Ozzy's dad made us all the same, like aluminium crosses.
And you wore them for years?
Yeah. Bill still wears his.
He does. Do you still have yours?
I think so, somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. That seems like a nice artifact. And when did you start to playing your own stuff?
Well, solo albums, probably 95 or something.
Was that a relief? Did you like it?
I loved it. Yeah, because it wasn't to make any money, because, you know, I knew it wasn't going to do anything. It's just like, I got to get all this stuff out of me.
Yeah.
And it was like ultra, ultra heavy stuff.
Oh, yeah. And what was the band called?
GZR.
Yeah, yeah. How's that? Do you have fans that love those things?
I wouldn't say love. Yeah, I mean, when I was doing the Sabbath thing, the people would come up with the albums sign to sign and everything. Yeah.
And your fans are pretty loyal, huh?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
That's why we're still here.
Yeah. And I interviewed Halford not long ago, and he loves you guys.
Yeah, well, he's a local guy as well.
Yeah, and he sang with you for a minute, right?
He did the Aussie Farewell Tour.
Yeah.
Ozzy wanted Ronnie refused to do it, which is when that particular lineup broke up.
Yeah.
And so we called Rob up and said, do you want to come to Ozzy's farewell?
This is the highlight of his life.
Always remember he went on stage. He didn't know he had an intro music. The intro was like 5 minutes long.
And he went out there.
He went on and he's like this with his bald head and all his black stuff. And the crowd are going, what the hell is Rob Halford doing? And he was just standing there going, well, how long is this thing going to go? But he's a good bloke, Rob.
And the only other time you played as the full band was for like one show, the charity show?
We did a whole tours.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, and an final album, 13.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is 2013.
And that's with Bill?
No, it started off with Bill.
Yeah.
And I thought he was doing great. And then I went on holiday. We had a break. I went on holiday to Hawaii, came back, and Bill wasn't in the band anymore.
Yeah.
I never got an explanation.
Well, oh, you don't know why?
No.
But he was like on and off heavy. Like he seemed like to have the least amount of control over the booze anyways.
He's been sober since 2002.
Oh, that's good. Saved his life, I bet.
Yeah, yeah. Because he had hepatitis through drinking vodka. And he survived that. And then I say in the book as well, when we were doing the Born Again album with Gil, and Bill was seeing these cottages in the sky.
Oh, right.
And he's like, I went into his bedroom and he's going, help, help.
Yeah.
I'm going tomorrow. He says, that cottage is going to land on me.
Yeah.
What are you on about? And he was having like delirious stuff from alcohol.
Oh, yeah. And then he got sober after that?
Took him to hospital. Literally, they kept him in hospital until they got rid of all the alcohol. Yeah.
Yeah.
And never went back to it after that.
Oh, that's good. And is he okay? Like, is everybody okay financially now?
Oh, yeah.
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 Oh, that's good. But after that last tour, like, how did that feel being with mostly the original lineup?
It was amazing because I never ever thought it was going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible. And then people were coming from all over the world at the last gig.
Yeah.
It was like a whole contingent from Japan.
Where was that? Where was the last gig?
In Birmingham.
Oh, my God. That must have been amazing.
Birmingham. Yeah.
And you look back at it and you're like, oh, we nailed it.
Yeah.
Because Ozzy can always do Ozzy, it seems like, for however long he's been able to do it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like he can just show up and he's like singular, you know. There's nobody quite like him. And you guys are close again?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's good. He's doing all right?
Yeah, I mean, we've only just started talking again because my wife and Sharon fell out over God knows what on the last tour in 2017. So I'd sort of lost touch with Ozzy, and he's not on the phone.
Yeah.
And then there's this thing in the Rolling Stone that he was calling me names for not asking how he was health-wise.
Yeah.
And I said, I've been sending you stuff, and I was sending him, like, how are you and all that.
Yeah,
texts.
Yeah.
And nobody was passing it on.
Oh.
And I explained, oh, I said, what about all the texts? What text? So we got back together now.
Oh,
so,
that's good.
Yeah.
And what have you been doing with your life lately?
This? No. Well, after the book, I don't know, just have it taking it easy.
And you like it?
I love it.
Do you play anymore?
Very rarely. Ever since I stopped boozing in 2015.
Yeah.
After a little battle in a pub. I haven't written anything since I gave up booze. Because I used to, the excuse for boozing was to go and write something.
Yeah.
So I'd be sitting in my studio and necking the old wine.
Yeah.
Beer or whatever. And getting like loads of inspiration.
Yeah.
And since I've stopped boozing, I haven't got the
You just same don't feel
thing.
Like it?
No.
But it's okay. You let it go.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think
so glad I gave up booze.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the worst drug of all, I think.
Yeah, because it destroys you and it's legal and you can kind of never stop. But also you were self-medicating, right? You think with the depression?
I had a nervous breakdown in 1999.
Yeah.
And I was finally went to the right person that told me what the depression was all about.
So yeah.
You're clinically depressed.
Yeah.
I started taking Prozac. And I was going, these aren't working. He said, you got to give it like 6 weeks.
Yeah.
6 weeks. After 6 weeks, I felt like a different person.
That's amazing.
Like everything that this is me again.
Wow. Because like I think you suggest in the book a little bit that a lot of the writing and a lot of the music was almost like a treatment.
It was the only way out, yeah.
Yeah.
So when I was, because I've had it since I was like a teenager.
Yeah.
On and off depression.
Yeah.
And that's what Paranoid's all about.
Yeah.
All those lyrics about how I couldn't talk to anybody about it.
Yeah.
And I used to go to the doctor and he'd go down the pub, have a couple of drinks, you'll be all right.
Right.
Or go and walk your dog.
Right.
Going, well, that's not working. Said, well, you can't have any. That's it.
Yeah.
Or they go into a mental hospital.
That was it. There was no gray area.
Yeah.
No therapy. No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it wasn't bad enough for me to go into a mental hospital.
Right.
So that's the best way for me was to write music and write the lyrics.
That's amazing because, like, you know, it kind of created the tone. Was your battle with depression?
Yeah.
Was to express the darkness. And there was enough darkness in the world for everybody to lock in.
There was, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was great talking to you, man.
Cheers.
Thanks so much. What a life. Am I right? The book Into the Void, From Birth to Black Sabbath and Beyond is now out in paperback wherever you get your books. Hang out for a minute, folks.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Hey, for Full Marin listeners, we posted another rare live WTF episode this week. It's from my 2010 show in Aspen with folks like Shane Moss, Hannibal Buress, and Michael Ian Black.
I don't mean to intimidate you. And is there anything I do to make our relationship better?
No, it's, in fairness, we don't really have a relationship. And haven't for probably a decade. But that through neither fault of our own, we just run in different circles. You know, I'm married and have kids and
a career.
Yeah. Career and
sure.
And you have other things.
Yeah, yeah. I have two failed marriages and
I didn't. I was not going to.
And a podcast. I have a podcast.
Again, you have other things, whatever those things may be.
Oh, what are you, Mr. Happy?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, me and Shane are pretty happy guys.
No, I understand your condescension, and I understand that. It's really a device you use to get approval. And I...
I didn't want this to be a battle. I came up thinking to myself, I'm going to let Mark know how much he has meant to me. And a tremendous amount.
Okay. All right, well...
So you can't take it. You can't take warm feelings. And I'm exuding warmth to you. You're more comfortable with me being a dick to you. because then it justifies your anger towards me and bitterness towards me. When in fact, I have nothing but admiration and love for you, and you can't handle that.
I can handle it, man.
Fuck you.
To get all our bonus episodes and every WTF episode ad-free, go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder, before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's a selection from the vault of past riffage.
Boomer lives. Monkey LaFonda. Cat angels everywhere.